As it was with Nero in ancient Rome, we Americans chose to fiddle while the world was catching fire around us. We were in the mood for recreation, and our national pastime was the world of sports. And radio was the making of many sports. Live broadcasts by skilled reporters from the scene of championship contests brought Americans right to ringside. And I must admit that the excitement of hearing a radio report was often far better than seeing it in person. Wherever boxing fans gather, the subject of the long count will still be discussed. The famous fight was between Gene Tunney and Jack Dempsey.
Ladies and gentlemen, main event, 10 rounds for the heavyweight championship of the world. Introducing from Salt Lake City, Utah, wearing black trunks, weighing 187 and a half pounds, former heavyweight king, Jack Dempsey. His opponent from New York City, wearing white trunks, weighing 195, heavyweight champion of the world, Gene Tunney.
In spite of the fact that I was hit seven times in succession in the seventh round in my contest with Jack Dempsey for the world's heavyweight championship, was one of my luckiest nights. As a matter of fact, the luckiest night of my life. Yes, I was down. I heard the referee count two. I knew I had to get up, which was part of my professional obligation. But what to do when I got up was the important thing. I decided to stay away from Jack, and it was a very wise decision, as the results showed.
The winner and still heavyweight champion, Gene Tunney.
Well, my thoughts was hoping he would never get up, but unfortunately he did, and won the fight, and more power to him. A great boy and a great champion.
The first Joe Louis-Max Schmeling encounter, as it was described by Graham McNamee.
Schmeling got over two more hard right to Lewis's jaw and made Lewis give ground. And there Schmeling straightened up Lewis with hard rights and left to the jaw. He has puffed up Lewis's left cheek and Lewis is down. Lewis is down, hanging to the rope, hanging badly. He is a very tired fighter. He is blinking his eyes, shaking his head. The count is done. The fight is over. The fight is over. And Schmeling is the winner. Lewis is completely out. They've had to lift him and carry him to his corner.
When the rematch came months later, expert opinion was mixed. First, let's hear what Jack Dempsey had to say.
Well, it's anybody's fight, but I favor Max Schmeling because I saw Joe Louis work out, and he looks to me like everybody's hitting him.
Gene Tunney saw it differently.
Well, I believe that if Louis gets the jump in the beginning of the fight, he'll win. But if he's going to allow himself to be maneuvered around by Schmeling, I believe that Schmeling is going to win.
Max Baer.
Well, I'm stringing along with Lewis this time, although in the last fight, I selected Schmeling. As a matter of fact, I want him to win, because I want to be the first fighter to regain the heavyweight championship.
Max Schmeling.
I'm feeling comfortable and in good shape. My walk here at the training camp has put me in the best of condition.
15 rounds for the world's heavyweight championship.
Right and left to the head, a left to the jaw, a right to the head, and Donovan is watching carefully. Lewis measures him, right to the body, a left hook to the jaw, and Schmeling is down. The count is 5, 5, 6, 7, 8. The men are in the ring. The fight is over on a technical knockout. Max Schmeling is beaten in one round.
The time, 2:04. First round. Referee stops it, the winner and still champion, Joe Louis.
I waited 2 years for the revenge and now I got it.
I'd like to fight Joe Louis again. If I have a chance, I will. But once I beat Joe Louis and Joe Louis beat me, now we're even. And I hope the next time we meet again, I beat him again.
Sport fans are still talking about the Olympic Games of 1936. They took place in Berlin, Germany, and a young American Negro named Jesse Owen scored an unprecedented triumph in several events. Jesse's victory was an unhappy shock to Olympic host Adolf Hitler, but for us, a national triumph, and for Jesse, a dramatic personal experience. Here he is with announcer Ted Husing.
Six boys walked out on the field unnoticed. Unnoticed because a German boy had won an Olympic victory and the crowd was giving him an ovation that was due an Olympic champion. As we sat there on that bench unnoticed, this is the sight that I saw within that wonderful area. As my eyes wandered across the field, I noticed a green grass, a red track with the white lines. And as my eyes wandered into the stands, I noticed 120,000 people sitting and standing within that great area. And as my eyes wandered upward again, I noticed a flag of every nation that was represented there in the Olympic Games underneath that German blue sky. My attention was diverted in that beautiful picture because a whistle had been blown. And we were to assemble around a starter to receive our...
Here are the lanes, ladies and gentlemen. From the inside to the outside, Jesse Owens on the pole. Lennart Strandberg of Sweden next to him in second lane. Eric Borschmeyer, the German, Borschmeyer. Jesse Owens is running in white shoes today. Ralph is running in black shoes. And here they go, down in the mark.
The starter stepped back about 10 paces, and he hollered in a loud German voice, "Auf für Plätze." And when he hollered, "Auf für Plätze," every man went to his mark. Adjusting our hands and our feet, the starter suddenly said in a soft voice, "Fertig." And when he hollered "Fertig," every man came to a set position.
The wind is blowing here, it's a little bit chilly. They're set. The gun sounds and they're away, and Jesse Owens from Galilee with Ralph Metcalf.
The boys ran neck and neck for 50 yards. Ralph Metcalf of Marquette University was leading the field at the 70-yard mark. And from the 70 to the 90, Ralph and I ran neck and neck.
Owen starts moving. He's a yard or two out in front. Metcalf is coming second up on him. It's Owen, Metcalf, and Ozendorf. Metcalf came in second. Ozendorf third. And
for some unknown reason, I beat Ralph Metcalf of Marquette University in this most historic event. But the greatest honor came as we stood up there around that pedestal of victory. And after we had knelt and received the wreath of victory from the German maidens, and standing there facing the stands, from a faraway distance, we could hear the strains of the Star-Spangled Banner. As the people in the stands stood, the Germans gave the Nazi salute, the Americans gave the American salute. And as we three on the pedestal of victory diddle our face, I noticed the stars and stripes rising higher and higher. And the higher the stars and stripes rose, the louder the strains of the Star-Spangled Banner were heard. And then and there I realized my ambition of 8 years to become a member of Uncle Sam's Olympic team, to emerge as a victor in the Olympic Games, provided me with my greatest moment throughout my whole athletic career.
International tensions again intruded into the world of sports in 1937. The semifinals of the Davis Cup matches that summer had America's Don Budge pitted against Germany's Baron Gottfried von Kramm. Don Budge describes the scene immediately after his narrow victory.
As Kramm and I were leaving the locker room, the telephone rang and Kramm was called back, and it was Hitler calling him to wish him good luck in this particular match. Of course, it was quite exciting because the fellow who had charge of getting the players out on the court on time had both of us by the arm. He wouldn't let Kramm go, and Kramm was saying, "Yes, mein Führer," this and that, and it got to be quite a tense moment. However, we finally did get out on the court, and I managed to win the third and fourth, and right away I was down 4-1 in the fifth set. I decided I had to get the net position away from him in the worst way, so with this in mind, I made up my mind I would try to return his serve and go in behind it. Well, as luck had it, I did manage to get my returns in, get into the net, and make some winning volleys. I broke his serve, and from there on it went to 6-all. Finally, at 7-6, I broke his serve, and after six match points, finally won the thing. After a great struggle, falling down on the ground on my last point, but making the shot nonetheless. But as we shook hands at the net, I'll never forget what Kramm said. He said, "Don," he said, "I'm very happy that I played so well against you, whom I like so much, and it was the best tennis I've ever played in my life, so congratulations to the best man on this particular occasion."
This was a blow to German prestige and a victory for America far out of proportion to the actual importance of the event. Horse racing gained a following, too, because of radio. Listen to the famed Whirlaway win the Kentucky Derby at Churchill Downs.
And Whirlaway is now making his dash in fifth place, and they're rounding the turn. And it is Disposed, and Porter's Cap at his head. Disposed by half a length. Porter's Cap has got him, and Blue Pair is right there. Whirlaway is cutting on the inside, and if he don't get blocked, he'll give him an awful drive. And Starator is right there. Porter's Cap is under a drive, heading for home. And Disposed is still there. Blue Pair cut the corner. Whirlaway has the lead by half a length. Porter's Cap has gone to a drive. It's Whirlaway by half a length, but Disposed is not yet beaten. No, Whirlaway pulls away. They've got 200 yards to come, and it's Whirlaway by 2.5 lengths. Porter's Cap is in second place by 1/2 length, and on the inside, Market Wise coming with a rush, but it's Whirlaway winning the race by 6 lengths.
Did you recognize that announcer? Yes, Clem McCarthy. That was in 1941. And the only four-time Kentucky Derby winner, Eddie Arcaro, the jockey. Undoubtedly, the most exciting moment in sports, though, came quite late, in fact, in 1951. Though television was on the spot, too, I think that radio really captured this moment in an epic of modern baseball. The scene is Ebbets Field. The New York Giants have surged from far behind to overtake the Brooklyn Dodgers and tie them for the National League championship. A playoff round of 3 games was needed to decide. After 2 games, the Giants and the Dodgers are tied. In the 3rd game, the Giants are at bat for the last time. 2 men are on base.
Bobby Thompson up there swinging. He's had 2 out of 3, a single and a double, and Billy Kraft is playing him right on the 3rd base line. One out, last of the ninth, back of pitches. Bobby Thompson takes a strike call on the inside corner. Bobby hitting at 292. He's had a single and a double, and he drove in the Giants' first run with a long fly to center. Brooklyn leads it 4-2. Hartung down the line at third, not taking any chances. Lockton without too big of a lead at second, but he'll be running like the wind if Thompson hits one. Franco throws. There's a long shot! I can't be, I believe! The Giants won the pennant! 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 Bobby Thompson hits into the very back of the left field stand! The Giants won the pennant! And they're going crazy! They're going crazy! Oh, oh! In a line drive into the lower deck of the left field stand, and the same place is going crazy. The Giants, Alan Stolen has got a winner. The Giants won it by a score of 5-4, and they're picking Bobby Thompson up and carrying him off the field.
After the game in the Giants clubhouse.
Ladies and gentlemen.
Hello, buddy.
Bobby, you drove in your 98th, 99th.
Oh,
how do you feel?
It was the 3rd one I drove in.
Bobby Thompson, did you fall down coming around 30?
I fell down. I didn't touch the ground once. Around,
you just flew off, Bobby.
Yeah.
Oh, that's wonderful.
Oh, it was a bad high that inside is fastball.
You said a bad high inside.
Oh, I don't know. Good living, I don't know what it is.
Oh, isn't that wonderful?
While in the Brooklyn clubhouse, the hapless pitcher, Ralph Branca, comments.
Let me alone. Go ahead, let me alone. Let me be, will you? You saw what happened. Things are tough enough. Yeah, I knew it was gone all the way. All I kept saying was sink, sink, sink. I knew he hit the ball. He uppercutted, hit the ball with overspin. It was like a curveball. It was sinking down. All I remember is seeing Paff go up against the wall, and then I was walking to the clubhouse. All I kept saying was, why me, why me? Why did he have to be me?
Just as exciting today as it was then.
It ought to be inconceivable that in this modern era and in the face of experience, any nation could be so foolish and ruthless as to run the risk of plunging the whole world into war by invading and violating, in contravention of solemn treaties, the territory of other nations that have done them no real harm and which are too weak to protect themselves adequately. Yet the peace of the world and the welfare and security of every nation, including our own, is today being threatened by that very thing. War is a contagion. Whether it be declared
all undeclared. If civilization is to survive, the principles of the Prince of Peace must be restored. Shattered trust between nations must be revived. America hates war. America America hopes for peace. Therefore, America actively engages in the search for peace.
Life went on. The Depression was lifting under the impetus of war orders from Europe. The draft was a fact, but we still enjoyed concerts and movies, and professional football was getting off to a good start.
Dodgers are ready to kick off now. They've just scored. Ace Parker did it. Jock Sutherland's boys lead the Giants 7-0. Here's the whistle. Merle Condon comes up. He boots it. It's a long one down to around the 3-yard line. Ward Tuff takes it. He's cutting up to his left. He's over the 10. Nice block there by Lehman. Tuff's still going. He's up to the 25. And now he's hit and hit hard about the 27-yard line. Bruiser Kennard made the tackle.
We interrupt this broadcast to bring you this important bulletin from the United Press. Flash, Washington. The White House announces Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor. Stay tuned to WOR for further developments, which will be broadcast immediately as received.